You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Maybe the best thing about getting the holidays behind us is finding time to escape to someplace quiet and bury yourself in a book. Especially with the heavy weather moving through this weekend, seems like it's going to be a fantastic weekend for reading. Keith Taylor is a poet, writer, and teacher, retired from the U of M's creative writing program, and he stops in to talk books with us every now and then. Keith, welcome back. How are you?
Good. How are you?
How was your holiday?
Mine was good. How about yours?
It was great. Is anybody crazy enough to buy you a book as a present, knowing how many books you probably already have?
Not many. It's too bad. I wish I got more books. But when people do, it's often a problem.
Well, why don't you tell us about one of the three books that you brought in to share today?
Okay. The first one I want to talk about is a book of photographs, which is tough to talk about on the radio, right? But it's called The Queen Next Door. It's by a reporter and photographer named Linda Solomon. The subtitle is Aretha Franklin, An Intimate Portrait. And it's got an interesting personal history to it. Solomon got to know Aretha when the singer came back to Detroit in the early 80s to help take care of her father. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, had been shot in an assassination attempt and went into a coma for several years before he died. So Aretha came back to help the family. Solomon was a columnist with the Detroit News, and Aretha was famously cautious around reporters.
How in the world did Solomon get this kind of access?
Well, for whatever reason, and I'm trying to think what this was, and I think it puzzles her too from what I can tell in the text in this book. Clearly, they just hit it off, and Aretha felt something, it might be chemistry, like between husband and wife, you know, or between President Obama and Pete Sousa, who photographed him. I mean, clearly they had something going on, other than words. And I think that happened with her and Solomon. I think Aretha might have also felt Solomon's discretion, and she's very discreet. For instance, in this book, Aretha never looks bad. The photographs aren't fancied up. They're not filtered. They're not photoshopped.
There are candids.
They're candids, but she's always well-dressed.
Yeah.
One of the few times she's not well-dressed is when she's sort of dressing casually with her rehearsal with James Brown.
Right.
But even casual with James Brown, Aretha looks great.
Right.
You know, it's she's not messing around.
You know, the word that comes to mind with this book, there are backstage pictures, there are onstage pictures, there are, pictures with friends and family. But the word that comes to mind is just sumptuous.
Exactly.
There is such a range of emotion and just snapshots of Black life that are just amazing to see in this
book. And Detroit life, all those politicians, all the musicians. There's a few white musicians in there too. She recorded with the Rolling Stones. And so there's an interesting picture of Aretha and Keith Richards, which I'd certainly never seen before.
What are some of your favorite moments in the book?
The cover photograph, which is atypical of the book, but where she's dressed for a masked ball as Nefertiti. And you look at this and you go, who else in America could get away with dressing as Nefertiti? I mean, nobody that I come, even some of the sort of wonderfully regal pop performers we have now, nobody but Aretha could have done that. And she just looks, she looks fabulous. And then there's some of the ones, if you live in this area long enough, you've heard lots of stories about her family, brothers and sisters, and people she worked with. And it's fun to see some of those pictures. And some of the pictures of the previous mayors, those are fun to see too. The commentary, Solomon's commentary, is very crisp, very short, and to the point. She seems to, it's mostly the 80s and early 90s, and then there are not a lot of pictures later on. Solomon was invited to the funeral and the memorial services and apparently took pictures there, but they're not in the book. She says in there at one point that most of my pictures are in the Aretha Franklin archive. So maybe that's the place where we're going to see Aretha angry or without makeup or, kicking up her heels a little. But we don't see that in this book. In this book, Aretha is the queen, which is kind of what we want her to be.
It's gorgeous. I kind of wanted to buy this for myself as the gift that I didn't get over the holidays.
There you go. Yeah, you should.
So the next book you brought, Respect, is a collection, actually, not specific to Aretha Franklin, that really gets at the global impact of Detroit's music scene, including Motown and beyond. It's a book of lyrics and poems. How do you describe the sensibility uniting this book?
Well, it's Detroit, and it's the history of music in Detroit. Certainly goes back, at least touches into the early 20th century, with some blues. and things. There are famous people. By the way, I just love the fact that the book on Detroit music is R-E-S-P-E-C-T. That just is I want to reiterate that. That's so right. The editors are Jim Daniels and M.L. Liebler, both longtime poets, natives of Detroit, been around for a long time. So you've got in this book, you've got lyrics by some of the great songwriters, Fats Domino, Billy Bragg, Robbie Robertson, Gordon Lightfoot, Jack White, Eminem, and a bunch of others. Mm-hmm. Then there's some poems of the great dead poets of Detroit, Robert Hayden, for instance, Philip Levine. Then there are poets of big national reputations who are either from Detroit or have come through here and spent time here.
Nikki Giovanni,
Toy Derricott,
sure.
Edward Hirsch, who's the president of the Guggenheim Foundation. And then there's a bunch of the rest of us who are who just sort of hang out here.
Including you.
Including me, right. Yeah. Which is, very generous of them to put in. And, of course, we're happy. I mean, my 28-year-old daughter's deeply impressed that I'm in a book with Eminem, You got to take what you can get when you're a poet in America.
Right. Could you pick one for us that you liked? Maybe a poem by someone you knew or someone you
didn't. Sure. This is by Ken Michalowski, who's still around. He's getting aged now. Oh, he'd hate me to say that. But it's a lovely poem of that time in the late 60s when things were so crazy in Detroit. And there were bands, the MC5 he talks about in here. Iggy Pop was around, he talks about in here. I mean, it's kind of like the precursors of punk were all in Detroit. It was after the riots. Detroit was tough. Detroit prided itself on tough. One of the great performance spaces was called the Grandy Ballroom. And it's the Grandy Ballroom's all through this book because it's a lot of the great performances. It's still, the building still exists. It's one of the buildings that nobody's decided to do anything with yet, but one hopes that they will because it's a pretty impressive building. And I just find this poem very funny. It feels very Detroit to me. So Ken Michalowski, At the Grandy Ballroom, 1968. John Sinclair, poet and manager of the MC5, asks other poets to read at the Grandy between sets. The night I get to be the intermission, the Stooges are the opening act. Iggy cuts himself up and bleeds all over the audience. They love it and go nuts and can't calm down. Brother J.C. Crawford calls out, and now a poet will read some poems. Most everyone boos and retreats to the parking lot to smoke some dope. That leaves me to read a couple of poems about life, love, and revolution. One of the few remaining members of the crowd yells, "F the revolution, bring on the MC5. Someone drops a drum on stage, and on that note, my reading is over. Just to imagine reading poems between Iggy and the MC5. It terrifies me, even the thought of it.
I'm sure it seemed like an awesome idea at the time.
I bet it did, too. Yeah.
Well, were there songs or artists that this book opened up for you in a little bit different way? I mean, there's a piece in there, Unreadable on a Family Radio Station by the late Jim Gustafson, that left me with a profoundly different view of the Stooges as frustrated and like trying to engage with the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are lots of those things. I mean, for instance, I've listened to Eminem a fair amount. I saw the movie 8 Mile and admired it, still do, just rewatched it again a couple months ago. But to read the lyrics to the 8 Mile song in here, where I can slow down and I can go back and read a line, I kind of get what, young people have known for, how old is that song now, 15 years?
Yeah.
Maybe more. Got a long time ago, that was really lyrically complex.
We've been talking about some of the works that refer to the punk roots of in Detroit and the hip hop era. There's a great poem in there by Nandi Comer, who's obviously one of the younger people on the scene right now. But there's also a lot of deep Detroit history in here. You brought a sort of period piece to this collection.
It's interesting. That's what the editor called it too. How did you know that?
I didn't. Oh. It's called Detroit Dancing 1948. You want to set this poem up for us?
Yeah, this is I married into Detroit 40 years ago. And my late father-in-law, who didn't particularly like me, I wasn't the image of who his daughter should marry, but he was from Detroit, Near East Side, and grew up there in the Polish neighborhoods. It's all gone now. It's all the Med Center. And he had some stories about Detroit. And when he died, I felt these stories are going to go with him. You know, some of them I want to save. And this one I did. This one I was able to pull out and get something out of it, and about his life in the years just after the war. Detroit Dancing, 1948, In Memoriam, Leo Golis. Everyone home from the war with stories to tell, except me, of course, just a bit too young to know the horrors of Iwo, Normandy, the Bulge. I spent the duration peddling popcorn outside a theater on Gratiot, later groceries at the market. No woman would be wowed by any yarn I could spin, and I'd never win a turkey with my looks. You see, everyone needs an angle. At the Polish National Alliance in Hamtramck, the women gathered dutifully around their returning heroes, wide-eyed in the presence of such courage. But when they danced alone, their arms circling the smoke from 100 cigarettes. With luck, one might find another woman anxious to show her grace. Think of it, years spent watching two women, 19 or 20, sway each other over the stained floor. So I taught myself dancing downstairs at home in the old neighborhood, humming Moonlight Serenade for rhythm, waltzing the broom, my partner, from coal bin to canning jars, learning to finish with a flourish, dipping its bristled head gently toward the cement, until I could walk into any club, anywhere in the city, pick out any woman, turn her once across the floor, and if I didn't sweep her off her feet, I hear at least, and this was almost enough then, that I was certainly light on mine.
That's such an amazing image of the two women dancing each other across the floor.
It is. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Absent the actual presence or absent the attention of men home from the war.
Yeah, just wanting to dance.
I really can't believe the chutzpah that it took to take on this project. I mean, covering everything from jazz giants who happened to be in Detroit, Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, and homegrown people like Farouk Bey.
Yes, and Farouk's in there. It's great.
The intense, you know, history of Motown. There are just some fabulous poems in here related to that period.
Yeah, and the editor, particularly M.L. Lieber, Jim Daniels even gives him credit for this, is just fearless. He wants to get an Eminem song. He doesn't say, oh, he's going to charge me $20,000. He just writes him and says, we're doing this thing about Detroit. And Eminem goes, yeah, of course I want to be in it. Jack White stood right up, we did the launch of this book at Jack Wright's Third Man, and it was like he gave us the space. We had 150 people in there reading the poems.
We're talking with Keith Taylor about three reads to get your January started properly. The third selection you brought is
very different.
It's not music from Michigan per se.
She's from Michigan. I think she's actually from Greater Detroit, but she lives in Grand Rapids, teaches at a college over there. Caitlin Horrocks. It's a historical novel about Erik Satie. So, you know,
The Vexations.
Vexations. And this takes place in Paris, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. It's a recreation of a very troubled life. Satie was wacko. Lived in this one little place out in the what were the suburbs. When somebody went in it after he died, it was a hoarder house, what we'd think of as a hoarder house. Smelled terrible. He'd come out dressed to the, you know, dressed as impeccably in his one suit that he wore day in, day out. And then he'd go off and work in the cabarets in way over on the right bank.
He lived in the suburbs of Paris, you say?
He did, in northern suburbs, yeah.
Sure.
And then he'd come in. Sometimes he didn't have enough money to come in. Mm-hmm. And then he would compose these exquisite little pieces. The Gymnopédie, which I suspect is where Caitlin Horrocks first ran across him. Little, very simple piano pieces that just have a few notes but are so evocative. If people don't put the name on that music, if they listen to the music, I suspect they recognize it. Oh, yeah, I heard that in an elevator one time. It's stuff that's around, like the air we breathe. It's like, oh, what's that? Well, somebody wrote it. This crazy guy living in Paris. And Caitlin Horrocks has written this sort of wonderful historical novel that tries to figure out how that happened.
We know Satie for the style that he developed, you know, just busting out of the romantic period with simple, austere gorgeousness that has been used in film after film after film.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And really paved the way for a more contemporary idea of music. How would you say Horrocks is, I mean, is she providing us some kind of parallel in her prose as she tells the family story that's at the heart of this narrative? How do you describe her approach?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there with the family narrative. It's a portrait of genius, but it's a portrait of what genius does to the people around it. Those people who are his vexations, his family, his siblings, the one woman who loves him in for a short time anyway. These people have found a way to support him, although he gives nothing back. So it's this, you know, don't love genius because genius won't love you back. Genius is too self-absorbed. Has to be too self-absorbed. And I think it's partly that story and then how it comes. She has a lovely phrase, which it's wonderful to quote. She says that the notes he came up with become so ubiquitous that they are nearly white noise. And then they catch your ear and are beautiful all over again. They are wallpaper that can make you cry. And I love that, you know, just sort of the music in the backgrounds of our lives. But if we take a second and hear a couple of notes, it's like, what is that? It's beautiful, you know. How does it happen? I mean, that's the mystery of it. It's so...
That's gorgeous.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's such an interesting snapshot, too, into Satie's world, someone who is a contemporary of Picasso and Jean Cocteau and everything that was happening in Paris at that time.
Yeah, and he was very central to it, too. I mean, those people were around Montmartre where he was, and you know, they all influenced each other.
Keith, before you go, we've just rolled into 2020, and I personally have ingested about all of the best of the decade lists I could possibly handle.
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? Yeah. Oh.
But I was curious, when you think about the books of the past 10 years, are there books, perhaps by Michigan writers or on Michigan themes, that you think we will still be talking about in another 10 years?
Oh, wow. I wish I had more time to think about that. You're catching me off guard.
Or just stuff that lit your world on fire.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I mean, the book that's sticking in my mind, the title's even going to escape me, but Carolyn Forché, who's originally a poet, originally from Michigan, she wrote a memoir about the year she spent as a young woman in Central America when Central America was torn apart by death squads and civil war. And that book just grabbed me and sort of tore me apart. The title is by Carolyn Forché, and the title is, if I'm remembering correctly, is What You Have Heard Is True, which comes from a poem of hers, a very famous prose poem about the horrors of those wars.
Well, that sounds amazing, too, and another one to add to the bookshelf. Keith Taylor, thank you for stopping in and talking to us about books today.
My pleasure. Hope we get to do it again. It's fun.